Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Season of Sports with me, Azhar Begovic. Great to be back with you guys once again. Really got a lot of things to get into. Good time of year. I'm a huge baseball fan, as you know, so I'm going to talk a little bit about baseball. Trade deadline's coming up. We're over halfway part of the season, so it gets quite exciting now. The playoff races heat up, and generally, just the baseball season really gets to a climax and then slowly heading into the playoffs. On this episode, you're going to hear from a special guest on the show, Steve Salas. He is an educator, author, mindset nurturer, works a lot with athletes on their mental health, and educates people on the state of things. So he's going to give us a really good insight. And I love getting people like this on every once in a while, just to talk about something different away from the day-to-day sports news. And he's going to give us a really good insight, so we're going to have a great chat with him, which I think you guys will all like. He's a great guy and really, really knows what he's talking about. So I think you really love hearing from him. He's a great guy and someone I have a huge amount of respect for. So, you know, I really hope that you enjoy listening to him. You can follow him everywhere. He's on Twitter, he's on Facebook, he's on Instagram, he's all over social media. So you can follow him and get some really good insight from Steve there. So really good. We're going to talk some baseball now, of course, and we'll finish off with the huddle. That's part of the show where I answer your questions. But before we do that, we're going to talk some baseball. We're going to get some of the deals so far. The trade deadline's right around the corner. It's a big push for the playoffs now. Last couple months of the season to go. Really exciting time, and you know, a lot of things to discuss. And a couple of the first moves that that happened recently is Homer Bailey being acquired by the Oakland Athletics, right-handed pitcher from the Kansas City Royals, and they also acquired left-handed reliever Jake Diekman from the Royals also, to really shore up that pitching staff. You know, I think they're very much in the wild card race. Whether they can chase down the Astros, who are first place in the division, remains to be seen. But overall, you know, the Athletics should get into the playoffs, and they'll be a formidable test for anyone. So well done to Billy Bean for really strengthening that team and making them stronger. The Chicago Cubs acquired left-handed pitcher Derek Holland to shore up their pitching staff from the Giants. And that was, you know, just depth move, so that's not bad. But moving on, probably the biggest trade so far at this moment in time, and one of the most bizarre ones, is Marcus Stroman heading to the New York Mets from the Toronto Blue Jays for a couple of pitching prospects. Now, the Mets, you know, they're just the Mets. I mean, for a couple of years now, for many years, they're in and around the playoffs. I know they had a World Series trip a few years ago now. They seem to think they're a contender, but they just every year seem more and more further away from being a contender than anything. And, you know, they keep trading away all their prospects. They did for Robinson Cano and Edwin Diaz in the offseason last year. And they're six games out of the second wildcard spot. So I think they're quite a bit away from being a contender and really pushing for any sort of championship. But that doesn't seem to be phasing them to try and add and try and compete and trying to push the other teams. You know, Marcus Stroman, he's one of the biggest pitchers in the market available this trade deadline. One of the other crazy things is he's a very much a ground ball pitcher. But the New York Mets have the worst ground ball infield defense in the league. So how that's going to mesh together, I don't know. I think ultimately, if you're the Mets, I mean, at some point you've got to tear this whole thing down. You've got a lot of pitching prospects now, Stroman, DeGrom, Syndergaard. Just trade these guys away. Get prospects, you know, absolutely stock up your farm system with all the prospects. Try and build for the future. Have something to build on and really get the fans excited in a couple of years, because this way of going forward, they're not here, not there. They're just treading along and not really achieving anything. So I think the Mets are just a crazy story. Then they traded away free agent to be pitcher Jason Vargas to the Phillies for a catching prospect. So, you know, with the Mets, you just honestly don't know what they're going to do. But a couple of teams who I think are very tricky positions is the San Francisco Giants. They've been an incredible run in the month of July to get themselves in contention. But their front office seems to want to keep the legacy players, Madison Bumgarner included, so all sort of those guys. Bruce Bochy, their manager, last season in the game. So I'm sure they want him to go out on a high. But what I have to say is, I think it's all smokescreen. I don't think they're as good of a team. I think, you know, you can really get your prospects in. Kind of what the Yankees did in 2016, I believe, when they sold off Chapman, Andrew Miller, all those guys, and just got some incredible prospects. And they really paid dividends in the last couple of years because they stocked up their farm system like you wouldn't believe it. And now they're able to really challenge and compete. And I thought maybe the Giants would be similar to that team. I know they don't have the same pieces as the Yankees in the farm system at the moment, but really, you know, I don't know if going forward it's something they need to do. But they've got a great fan base. They maybe owe it to their fans to really go for it if they're in the hunt. So that's a tricky one. As for my Yankees, well, we're desperate for starting pitching. So I'm sure Brian Cashman, the GM, is gonna get a frontline starter, not a four, number four, number five. I think he's gonna have to get a frontline starter. Stroman doesn't seem to be available, so someone like Robbie Ray, maybe a Trevor Bauer from the Indians would be great to get. So I'm hoping that Brian Cashman works his magic once again. So that's enough baseball talk. Maybe we'll dissect the trade deadline next week, and then get in some football talk. But before we do that, I want to talk to you about our sponsor for the pod, CompareMyVPN.com. Really support us. Loved having them as part of our pod. Make sure you check them out. Go on their website, CompareMyVPN.com. They're the best independent VPN review sites. Visit them for exclusive VPN special offers available on the market. A VPN will enhance your online privacy, unblock popular streaming content and live sporting events. So well worth checking them out. Really great company. We appreciate their support. So we're gonna get into our chat with Steve Salas now, and then we'll finish off with a huddle after. So joining me now on the Season of Sports is author of the book Educating Football, is a performance coach and mindset guru, Steve Salas. Steve, welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you. Very kind. And thank you for having me, and welcome to your listeners as well.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I've been wanting to get you on for quite a long time now to talk about everything that you do and educate a lot of our listeners on the things that you're involved in. But I wanted to take you back a little bit first to the beginning. I know you were a player back in the day. You spent 8 years at Brighton. How do you look back on your career as a footballer?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and I appreciate you asking me. I haven't been asked that in many years. It was a long, long time ago, and I suppose that I remember my first ever game of football, 11v11, as a six-year-old, and I was playing for the under-9s.
Yeah.
I remember my dad shouting at me, telling me to get goal side, and I was screaming at him, saying the goal's that way, on the other end of the pitch. I don't really remember anything other than, I know that sounds, this is not meant to sound crash as me, I remember being just quite gifted and not really knowing why.
Yeah.
So I scored, you know, just an 11-year-old, scored 100 goals a season, as you do when you're 11. Well, not as you do, but, you know, in terms of me just being all right. And then I just remember getting spotted by several scouts and just really just not really thinking about the game in that deep way. Anyway, sort of 7-8 years later, I sort of realised that after coming, I broke my leg as a scholar, to be fair. That probably didn't help me, but I often say, and I call myself on Twitter, a failed football player. A few people pulled me and said I shouldn't really say it, but there was players out there, Admir, that were probably better than me, and I mean that sincerely. You know, Frank Lampard was my age group. He was a step ahead of me. Nigel Quasi played in the Prem for a long time. Stephen Clement. So those guys ended up playing in the Prem, and I suppose I have to be honest with myself that there's a shelf life for everybody, I believe, and whether I hadn't had the right coaching or it wasn't me, you know, no excuse culture is my point. I truly believe I just wasn't good enough to play at that level, mate, if I'm honest.
Well, I think that's a very honest assessment, first and foremost. A little bit harsh, I would say, maybe in some things, but I think a lot of players, you know, who have had things happen to them or played for maybe shorter time than they expected, don't ever quite come to terms with why it didn't go right, and probably live their lives a long, you know, long ways in regret in a way. So I think it's very refreshing to hear you speak that way, and you seem to have come to terms with what happened, and you moved on to other things, which brings me on to your next chapter. You've moved on into teaching, into coaching. You're now an elite development expert, a keynote speaker. How did your transition work out? How do you feel about everything and your next steps in your life?
Yeah, it's a question I reflect on very, very regularly. I think you sometimes the luck that you need in life and your environment can define you. I was from a working class family in Brighton. My dad was a builder, my mum was a housewife, and all my dad ever used to say to me was, "Don't do what I do," as in him not enjoying his job very well. So I was very fortunate. I was from a sort of aspirational family of self-improvement and just wanting to better ourselves. Now, obviously, when you're a child, you don't think about it as deeply as that. But when I reflect back on it and I'm thinking how fortunate I was to have parents that pushed me to have a better life than they had. So linking that in is my older brother, who's 41 now, is now a school principal. So I always had him as a role model, and I mean this genuinely. If I think deeply about it, you know, little brothers follow their big brothers if they're good role models, don't they? Yeah. My brother was a sportsman. He did his degree in PE as well. But at the same time, I was probably a bit more, as my dad would say, I was a bit more X factor as a performer than he was. He's a good golfer. He's a county hockey player. He played football semi-pro as well. So we always had those things in common. We spent our life in the park. And anyway, he went to Greenwich University. And I followed him there. And it was interesting because he left. So we're both Brighton born on the south coast of England. And he left to go to university. And when he left, I started at the same uni. So I suppose that journey was almost quite natural because I followed my big brother. And, you know, he is my mentor, my guide. I'm my own man, of course. But at the same time, I think that there's an element of luck to that journey. I will say this. And then anyway, sort of 20 years later, I will say one thing that I've got that he hasn't got. I worked in sort of crazy schools in South London for a long, long time. And if I'm honest, Asmir, that's the one thing that's defined me to how I'm able to influence people now.
Well, I think that's incredible. I think working your way up and having these experiences plays a big part in developing and getting to certain stages in your life. So moving on to more on the football side, and again, a big reason why I wanted to get you on is we'll get into a little bit later, but obviously educating people about the mindset. Educating football, your book, how did that come about? What exactly is it about? And what made you want to get into it?
Yeah, well, I'll go back one step. The reason I started writing the book was because 3 years before, as a vice principal of a school in London, I was doing my master's degree part-time. So I did my first degree 15 years earlier, and I've been teaching, and it got to that stage in my career where I needed bettering. And I actually got my master's degree for free because as a London teacher, they were so desperate to keep teachers in London because of all the difficulties that the University of King's College London, obviously one of the most famous unis in the world, they offered me a free degree, which was you know, unusual, but I was very privileged. So my point being that it changed my life. It changed my personal life and it changed my professional life. Anyway, cut a long story short, I've been doing that for 3 years after work and in school holidays. And then the year I finished my master's degree was the year I left teaching and joined Millwall. So it was a big move, big career move to join a professional football club, Millwall, South London club, you know, famous for lots of reasons, good and bad. And I decided, literally I went into the training ground one morning after about a month of working there, and the goalie coach, you know, obviously the goalie crew, he said to me, Seb Barton, who's now working at Arsenal, he said to me, Salis, he said, you know, you should write a book. And do you know what, Asmir, I was in such habits of writing for my master's degree, I was a bit of like, bit of a come down from like, you know, what do I do with myself in the evening? And that night I went home and I wrote my first chapter. And so, to be honest with you, I've been writing for 8 years now, you know, master's for 3 years and the book for 5 years. Wow. So it was all a bit organic, really. It was just an idea from a colleague that told me to crack on, and away I went.
Fantastic. So the book is about how parents and teachers and coaches can develop a solutions mindset. Define solution mindset.
Well, the solutions mindset is my business title, so solutionsmindset.com. And that goes back again. I said this to you in the first question you asked me, that where teach and define me, and it really did. Let me explain why. As a vice principal, I used to have a sign on my door saying, please don't come into my office without a solution. And that was actually destined for the kids and for the staff. and just trying to change the mindset of people in a very negative environment. So really my book's, I've said this many times on many podcasts, it has as many questions as it does answers. And the reason it has is because I don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
And what I want people to understand in the book is about people's lens. And obviously me and you have been, it's been speaking for several months, and my lens is not your lens, and your lens is not, you know, Junior Stanislas's lens. And obviously we both have him in common as well, being his former teacher. And my lens is not my father's lens. And my point being about the book is that all I can do is give people as big a toolbox as possible for in order them to gauge how this book can help them in their context, in their situation, in their part of their life, in their coaching. And I suppose I'm like that, Asmir, because I got so fed up with sitting in inset training days as a teacher and as a coach for so many years of people telling me what to do. And I used to find it quite frustrating. So really, that was the really model of the style of the book, to be honest, mate.
Yeah, and I love that. And I think one thing that I've learned through my career, I think firstly is that experience is obviously is crucial. They mold you into the person that you are. You learn through life. Life is a big teacher. And that's the same way in football. There's always a solution to every problem. How can you get better? How can you find that solution is why we do what we do. That's the process of being a footballer. How can you get better at something? How can you work on something? If something isn't quite going well, how do you fix it? So that's the sort of process and mindset I think as an athlete is very important to have. And that's something that keeps you in the game, and I think generally in life keeps you around in a profession for a long time. So I think I love the way you speak about it, the fact that there are sometimes more questions than answers, but trying to find that solution is obviously the most tricky part. So I'm a big fan of it, developing the mindset, developing your own mindset, and how you can get stronger mentally is a huge thing. Moving on to a little bit more of the practical thing, what's the sort of main issues players come to you with? How do you help them the most?
Yeah, I saw a player. I was speaking at the Football League conference yesterday, as you know, and I drove down the M1. And I saw a couple of players last night that I deal with. One's in the Premier League and one's in League Two. And they both have very similar situations, although playing at different levels. But generally, the trends of things that players see me about is lack of confidence. It's worrying about their future career, their career beyond football. It's worrying about current performance. So performance psychology is a big part of my methodology. It's potentially personal issues. And I think my experience as a teacher, again, has enabled me to have that caveat. I mean, it's important to emphasise, I'm not a sports psychologist. I call myself a mental conditioning coach. And I'm not being derogatory to sports psychologists out there. But what I am saying is that I've got 20 years of applied practice in terms of pastoral care. And so one-to-one work is important, but I've worked in schools of 2,500 children. So if you're not able to manage yourself as well as manage others, you're going to be in trouble. So, yeah, really my job in terms of elite athletes and developing that is just to try and give them the toolbox that I have, Asmir, and I say this very confidently, I have to coach myself out of a job. If they're still contacting me in a year's time, I've pretty much failed.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a way where we can't stay in touch. Of course we can stay in touch, but I think it's important that I've got to give them my toolbox. They've got to take what they want and discard what they don't want, and I don't take any offence to that. There'll be some things that I say to certain individuals that are very relevant. There'll be some things that are completely not appropriate for them to use. And I think, again, it's all about, I keep saying, the toolbox. If I can give them something that can add value to their performance or non-performance life, then I'm doing my job. And I suppose the beautiful thing about where I'm at the moment is most of my work is word of mouth, really. One player will speak to another player, and then, you know, that's what will give me all my clients.
Perfect. No, and I think that's the best way. I think when you gain trust within the game to help athletes and people, I think that's a huge thing. The sort of last thing I wanted to touch on a little bit, I mean, you sort of said it earlier in your life story, was, oh, your dad shouting at you, get goal side and things like that. I see a lot of issues now for the next generation. You know, like I'm 32 this summer. it's a different generation now than when we played. So we were probably hardened up a little bit, and we're not as I guess keen to follow what people say in on the outside world. So you develop your own way of working. But now the next generation, you have pressures from social media. Everything you do is so scrutinized. Everything is seen. Everything is documented. For that next generation player, what sort of advice do you have? And the second part of my question, to go even a little bit beyond that, grassroots, parents, players, what can you suggest to them to kind of not put pressure onto kids too soon and let them be the best version of themselves?
Yeah, so we'll start with player-centered approach first. I'm a big believer in core values. Core values are stolen from, you know, they say the best coaches are the best thieves, right? So I've stolen that from Dave Brailsford, who was the Sky Cycling, head of Sky Cycling, and he talks about commitment, ownership and responsibility. And if you get those things, that equals excellence. So that's something that I talk to old players and young players about nearly in every session that I say. If the player's not committed and they don't own their behaviours and their process to be elite, and they're not responsible towards that, then they'll never get excellent. So that's something for your listeners to research and look up. I think the importance, without saying again, about resilience, and you know, I have another saying that there's no failure, there's only feedback. And I know that's linked from Carol Dweck and her growth mindset. So I urge your listeners to, if you don't know about Carol Dweck, is to go and look her up. Terms of, you know, child psychology and educational psychology, that'd be something that'll be, you know, really add to the repertoire of your listeners and coaches. But from that point of view, really the external influences from the parents. I have a chapter in my book called The Wrong Type of Love and Parent Envy, which is basically how to hinder your children. So it's slightly tongue-in-cheek in terms of the title. Obviously you would normally want to help your own children, but I've chaptered the title How to Hinder Your Children. And really, it's a little bit about, you know, I don't know about necessarily Eastern European cultures, but I do know about UK culture. And I know that there's many parents out there that are destroying the enjoyment of their own son or daughter's experiences, and let alone also destroying their experiences of becoming elite in the future because of their own behaviour. So, yeah, parents have got to be very, very careful. And I urge them to look up people like Carol Dweck. And you know, she's the top educational psychologist in the world right now, and she talks complete sense in terms of resilience and how we look at failure, really. So yeah, parents in summary, Asmir, parents have to be very, very careful that they are there to parent and not there to parent and coach and be the taxi driver and the chef. You know, it's hard for parents, I appreciate, but it's important that they do their own research about how to be a sporting parent.
Beautiful, beautiful. No, I think that's amazing, amazing feedback, amazing advice for listeners out there and people out there. And I think it goes a long way because there are issues at every level, but grassroots, I think that's a big issue. And I know it's a huge responsibility for any parent, but I think there is ways of dealing with things better. But listen, Steve, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Love your expertise on this. Tell us a little bit about where we can follow you on Twitter. I know your book, Educating Football, is available Amazon, everywhere pretty much you can get it. But tell us where you are on Twitter, where people can follow you, and make sure to keep up to date with things.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, actually, the book isn't, to be fair, on Amazon. It's on Educating Football website. So quite easy, really. Just follow the website to Educating Football. LinkedIn is obviously Steve Salas, and my main Twitter feed is at Stephen Salas. I have a couple of others at Soccer Doctor UK and Solutions Mindset, which is my business. So, mate, all in all, thank you. I'm very privileged to be speaking on your podcast. And I know that, you know, you're well respected in the UK, mate, as someone that's, you know, a very measured, intelligent guy. And I'm very privileged to share my time with you.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is all mine. And hope to have you on again very, very soon. Thanks a lot, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Moving on to our huddle now. What a great chat we have with Steve. You know, I really appreciate him coming on. I always get smarter talking to him. He's just a great guy, just an all around great person who's growing the game, making an impact, helping athletes, helping people. Just a great person to have around. So, you know, great to have him here in the Season of Sports. Really thank him for his time. We're going to get a couple of questions. Well, we've just had recently a poll on Twitter to see who people thought would be the the most active teams before the trade deadline. Seems to think 60% of you think it's the Yankees, 40% the Mets. The Mets have done a couple of deals. So far, the Mets are winning that race, so I can see why people voted for them. But the Yankees, I'm sure, will make a move. We also had the Dodgers on there or another team. But people seem to think the two New York teams are going to do a lot of action. So far, the Mets have, and I'm sure the Yankees will pick it up to make sure that those those things really come to fruition and take it from there. So let's get into a question here on Twitter from McCaffrey at Abd1 Rahim. He asks, what are your thoughts on people putting Pat Mahomes as a top three quarterback in the league with TB12 and Rodgers? I personally think Andrew Luck is better than Mahomes. Abdi. Well, listen, Abdi, I think it's a great question. Andrew Luck, he's probably had a better career. Of course, he's been in the league longer than Mahomes. I would put my top three. I would put Tom Brady, Mahomes, and Luck. I don't think Aaron Rodgers, at this moment in time, I would put him in the top three. He's probably still top five or six with likes of Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, those kind of quarterbacks. But my top three would be Luck, Brady, and Mahomes. So whether you want to say Luck is better than Mahomes, that's your shout. But I think those are the top three quarterbacks who really make the teams better and are crucial to the team's success. So I would say those three. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Pat Mahomes, Andrew Luck. To watch these guys is amazing. So I would put those as my top three, ahead of Aaron Rodgers. But you know, everyone has their taste. So great question. Keep them coming in, guys. We'll keep the episodes coming in regularly as we can. Get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're all over there. Keep listening to our podcast wherever you get podcasts from: Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audio Boom. We appreciate the support. Leave us a review, positive or negative. Love to hear from you guys, and I'll be back with you very, very soon. Thanks a lot.